500 U.S. soldiers who were involved in the killing of hundreds of African Americans in this massacre?
Yes, Amy, this made a cover-up much more difficult compared to other anti-black massacres, say in Rosewood, Florida, or the Ocoee massacre in Florida. The governor requested federal troops. These troops were supposed to restore order. In fact, many of them engaged in the massacre. They shot people down in the streets. They shot people down in the woods. And so, again, those murders were never prosecuted.
Well, we can't leave it there, so we're going to continue this conversation and bring you part two at democracynow.org. Paul Ortiz, professor of history and director of the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program at University of Florida, Gainesville, and the Julia Wright, the daughter of the literary giant Richard Wright, who wrote Black Boy and Native Son. That does it for our show. Happy birthday, Becca Staley. I'll be speaking at Penn State and at Brown this week. Check democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman.
You are tuned to KBOO. Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, two Oregon racial justice protesters get landmark damages for violence at the hands of police. Washington Community College staffers look for pay equity. And in international news, congressional action ratchets up tension with China. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 4th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. A jury found that the Portland Police Bureau is liable for battery and unreasonable force in a 2020 racial justice protest that left Aaron Wenzel with a broken arm and PTSD. It's the first 2020 protest suit against the Portland Police to make it to a jury. The jury awarded Wenzel, a protest medic, $40,000 in damages. They didn't find, though, that the police were liable for assault or making someone afraid that they would be physically hurt, nor did they find the police responsible for negligent training of its officers. There wasn't video of the incident where police smashed Wenzel into the ground and hit her with a baton, and the judge limited the amount of other evidence that could be admissible. For more than 50 other lawsuits following this one, though, the trial has important indicators as to what juries and judges will accept as evidence. Wenzel could not identify the police officers who hurt her on August 14, 2020. This is because the officers were not wearing their name tags while responding to protests. Lawyers for people hurt by Portland police during protests in 2020 say the result of the jury trial bodes well for future cases. Attorney Juan Chavez told the Portland Mercury that the $40,000 settlement gives lawyers, quote, a yardstick where we didn't have one when it comes to proposing damages to juries. Chavez continued, quote, that will be a type of anchor for us to use where there's no video and a comparable injury. This is what we can point to when we're negotiating. It's a net positive for the community. It takes brave plaintiffs to come forward and get to this point. A racial justice protester in Salem has been awarded significant damages as well in a lawsuit against police for violating her civil liberties. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
A jury awarded more than $1 million to a racial justice demonstrator who filed a federal lawsuit against the city of Salem about 2 years ago. The lawsuit accused police officers of violating her civil rights. Ella Kaya McCray alleged police had intentionally targeted black people through use of deadly force during a protest which followed the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officers. McCray, who is black, attended a demonstration on May 31, 2020. Demonstrators were met by police in riot gear, according to McCray's attorney. The jury found McCray proved that Officer Robert Johnston shot her in the eye and chest with rubber bullets, violating her Fourth Amendment right not to be subjected to excessive force. McCray said the bullets caused permanent vision loss and a chest injury. However, the jury also found she did not prove that Johnston violated her First Amendment right to lawful assembly or that he committed battery against her. A U.S. district judge previously threw out her claim officers intended to inflict emotional distress on her based on her race. The city said McCray's injuries, if any, were due to her own, quote, negligent conduct by failing to disperse the area when the protests were no longer peaceful, end quote. Salem officials did say they appreciated the jury's work on this case and respect its verdict. McRae was awarded $250,000 in economic and $800,000 in non-economic losses. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Washington State Community and Technical College employees are already focusing on January's legislative session in Olympia. One of their main issues is pay parity between adjunct and full-time professors. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Community and Technical College faculty members are preparing for the legislative session in Olympia. Among the top priorities for the American Federation of Teachers of Washington is pay parity between adjunct or contingent professors and their full-time peers. Jackie Kane is contingent faculty at Pierce College and a member of AFT Washington. She says some colleges are doing better on pay, but at others, adjunct professors make about half what full-time faculty makes, doing the same work.
We are having a hard time keeping contingent faculty in the workforce, and one of the number one reasons I hear is the fact that these jobs are not sustainable. A lot of the faculty start out doing this for a few years with the idea that it's going to result in full-time work. For many people, that just doesn't happen.
Kane says because adjunct teaching jobs are low paid, it can also hurt diversity in the profession. She says her organization also will be pushing lawmakers to approve more wraparound services for students and removing barriers for DACA students. The pandemic has affected students' performance across the board. Kane says they can be seen in lower test scores from high schoolers who were relegated to remote classes. In light of this, her union would like to see free college tuition for students' first 2 years of school.
Because of COVID and because of the damage that was done to the educational experience, we're going to be advocating for free college for those students coming out so that they won't be disproportionately impacted by what we've gone through for the last 2 years and can sort of make up that work.
Kane says the union has worked with a coalition of groups in the past in Olympia, including the Washington Education Association and the student-led Communities for Our Colleges. The legislative session starts in January. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The FBI says China and Russia are sowing election integrity disinformation, and President Biden commits $60 million to help Puerto Rico. With those stories and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Authoritarian actors, autocratic actors, are leveraging these platforms to get their messages out there.
The FBI says Russian and Chinese operatives are promoting misinformation online about the integrity of U.S. elections ahead of November's midterms. Former director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, Chris Kerbs, explains foreign influences exploit conversations on social media.
From a disinformation perspective, we don't see a lot of organic narrative from adversaries. What they're doing is latching on to existing narratives and taking both sides of an issue.
FBI officials noted there is currently no evidence of credible threats to election operation systems, but investigators are monitoring possible threats to election workers. The death toll from Hurricane Ian in Florida is now at least 100 lives lost. The Category 4 hurricane decimated coastal towns where crews search for survivors. More than 1,600 people have been rescued since last week. Search and rescue efforts also continue in Puerto Rico, which was devastated by Hurricane Fiona just a few weeks ago.
We want to be treated in the same way as our fellow Americans in the States in times of need. All American citizens, regardless of where they live in the United States, should receive the same support from the federal government.
That's Puerto Rico Governor Pedro Pierluisi, who welcomed a visit from President Joe Biden on Monday. Biden promised more than $60 million to boost the island's defenses against future storms. The Supreme Court started its new term Monday with the courtroom open to the public for the first time since March 2020. Its newest member, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, eagerly asked questions during arguments on a business-backed challenge of Clean Water Act provisions. Other cases the court will consider this term include issues related to race, elections, free speech, and LGBTQ rights. In Washington, D.C.'s federal courthouse, the trial began for the five members of the alt-right group, the Oath Keepers, who pleaded not guilty to the charge of seditious conspiracy. Prosecutors say the men planned an armed rebellion on January 6, 2021, to keep former President Donald Trump in office. The defense countered the group had no plan to overthrow the government. Former President Donald Trump is seeking $475 million in damages from CNN in a new defamation case. Trump's lawyers claim the network used its influence in a smear campaign for the purpose of defeating him politically in 2020. Now to New York City, where Mayor Eric Adams called for a unified response as his city copes with an unprecedented influx of migrants arriving from southern border states.
The far right is doing the wrong thing. The far left is doing nothing. I mean, the silence, I don't believe the silence that I'm hearing. These are people in need of services.
More than 16,000 migrants have arrived in New York City since May. Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott started relocating migrants in early August to protest the Biden administration's border policies. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The White House just concluded its first conference on hunger in 50 years. And in California, advocacy groups say they're ready to see the many proposals put into action. Suzanne Potter has more on the results of that conference.
Groups that fight hunger in California say untold suffering could be avoided if the policies championed at the latest White House conference are put into place. The event was the first of its kind in 50 years, bringing together government agencies, nonprofits, and private companies with the goal of wiping out hunger in the U.S. by 2030. Itzel Gutierrez with the California Association of Food Banks says she was glad to hear President Joe Biden voice support for strategies to reduce poverty and thus fight hunger.
We were very excited to see you raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour and also expanding earned income tax credit in addition to the child tax credit, and also investments in housing and rental assistance.
The conference also promoted ideas long championed by the California Hunger Action Coalition, including expanding free school meals to all kids and allowing college students, recent immigrants, and formerly incarcerated people to participate in CalFresh. Gutierrez said she was disappointed that the conference made little mention of food insecurity in undocumented families, and many of the proposals face significant Republican opposition in Congress based on cost concerns. Tracy Weatherby with the Second Harvest of Silicon Valley Food Bank says 60% of its clients have less than $250 in savings, and the financial squeeze will get worse once the feds declare the public health emergency is over.
The White House strategy comes at a crucial time as nearly all pandemic-era social safety net programs are ending, while food, gas, rent, and other prices are rising. And that's really leaving families across the country struggling to cover their basic costs.
When that happens, she says, CalFresh benefits are slated to drop an average of $82 a month. But Todd Cunningham with the Los Angeles Community Action Network, known as LA CAN, says the pandemic proved that when there's a will, there's a way.
Not only did they do the school meals for all during the regular school year, but also when summer came around. And they also came up with solutions for people who couldn't make it to school to pick them up. We've seen that we can actually come up with creative solutions if we just put our minds to it and we have the will to do it.
Statistics show one in five households in the U.S. experiences food insecurity, with deeper disparities for Black and Latino communities. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special rebroadcast of my interview with author Tom Hartman on his book, The Hidden History of Neoliberalism. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, stick around for Rising Up with Sonali. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 55 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will see some clouds and a bit of sunshine with a high of 76. Today in history, in 2006, WikiLeaks launched. It's an international organization that publishes news leaks and classified media from anonymous sources. The quote of the day is from American author Anne Rice, who was born today in 1941. Rice said, quote, "You do have a story inside you. It lies articulate and waiting to be written behind your silence and your suffering." Haskell Indian Nations University students walk in remembrance of Indian school victims. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal college students at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas, recently held a walk and remembrance for those who did not return home from Indian boarding schools and for survivors and their families. Students walked the campus wearing orange shirts to recognize the experiences of Native people. The shirts also represent the notion every child matters. The federally funded church-run schools in the U.S. mirror residential schools in Canada. This summer in Canada, Pope Francis apologized on behalf of the Catholic Church to Indigenous people in that country for the abuses they suffered at residential schools. Haskell Student Government Association President Darren Berryhill says the Pope needs to do the same for Indigenous people in the U.S.
I think it should be highly acknowledged for, you know, boarding schools all around the U.S. It's like a very big impact that's happened to Indigenous people everywhere and impact the future generations. And here we are, you know, as of today, we are our own people and we have that history. And like, I think anybody with the boarding schools as well as, you know, whatever countries should all be involved and highlighted about the history of what happened.
Berryhill says the event at Haskell not only raised awareness of boarding schools, but also brought students together for reflection, as Haskell has its own history as a boarding school.
At the same time, you know, you got to understand like how like sentimental and sensitive the subject might be talked about a lot, but it's also like the one of the main importance of Haskell Indian Nations University. And I love the idea of that we bring this up and we have a prayer and a song about it, because like it really brings us all together today as of what happened in our history, and we're also like embracing what happened here before it was a university.
Similar events were held across the U.S. and Canada, known as Orange Shirt Day, on September 30th. In Canada, the statutory holiday, National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, is observed. Meanwhile, the Interior Department is planning to hold its next boarding school healing event, this time in South Dakota. Officials will gather testimony about the impacts of boarding schools at the October 15th event on the Rosebud Reservation. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland is traveling across the country hosting listening sessions as part of her investigation into federal Indian boarding schools. The Biden administration is holding a government-to-government summit Tuesday and Wednesday in Washington, D.C. with tribal leaders. The two-day event hosted by the Department of Energy is to explore tribal energy sovereignty. Wahela Johns is director of the agency's Office of Indian Energy Policy and Programs. She says there are many opportunities for tribes to invest in clean energy.
There's opportunities in geothermal. There's opportunities in small hydro, and energy storage is a big one. There's also looking at the build out of making sure that, you know, the supply chain is coming from the United States internally. And so there's a lot of incentives for manufacturing and repurposing of former, you know, coal mine sites. Tribes, you know, we all have a beautiful relationship with everything around us, our Mother Earth and our environment. And many of the goals, the climate goals, fit in line with the vision that communities have in caretaking.
John says the Energy Department will be managing billions of dollars to roll out clean energy, and the agency wants to make sure tribes are involved. Tribal leaders at the summit will be interacting with top agency officials. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Gas flaring is a commonly used practice among oil and gas producers to reduce methane emissions from their operations, but a new study raises concerns about its effectiveness and its impact on the climate. Mike Moen reports in North Dakota.
A new study says gas flaring in oil-producing states like North Dakota isn't as effective in limiting harmful emissions when compared to long-standing estimates. Flaring involves burning off excess natural gas that accumulates during oil extraction. The emission in question, methane, has been found to be a more powerful pollutant than carbon dioxide. The industry has long worked under the assumption that flaring at oil and gas fields is 98% effective at reducing methane. But the new study says the rate is actually closer to 91%. Linda Weiss with the Dakota Resource Council lives near the Bakken oil fields. She says it confirms many of her fears.
You can't see most of these gases, and you don't know what long-term effects they'll have on the human body.
Health experts have said long-term exposure can result in a range of health problems, including heart and breathing issues. And environmental groups say methane is a huge driver of climate change. The study's authors now believe flaring emits five times more methane in the U.S. than previously thought. State officials argue that infrastructure upgrades have led to a smaller percentage of gas being flared in North Dakota. The study looked at operations in North Dakota and Texas. Environmental Defense Fund's John Goldstein says these two states are home to more than 80% of gas flaring in the U.S.
So those are two states that have a lot of flaring and that haven't done adequate measures at the state level to really curtail that practice.
He encourages them to follow the leads of New Mexico and Colorado, which have been more aggressive in addressing the issue, including enhanced inspections. And environmental groups hope the issue draws more attention as the EPA considers tougher federal regulations. Meanwhile, North Dakota officials say they inspect producing sites monthly and follow up to eliminate unlit flares, which, left unattended, can release unburned methane directly into the atmosphere. Mike Moen, Prairie News Service.
Taiwan is judged to be the flashpoint between U.S. and China's tensions, and recent congressional action could make things even more tense. Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. China watchers now believe that Taiwan is the main flashpoint in U.S.-China relations. Over the past several years, a once relatively stable security situation has slowly deteriorated, with both China and the U.S. taking actions that have raised the risk of a serious confrontation, one that both governments say they're anxious to avoid, but blame the other for escalating. Now comes a move in the U.S. Senate that will surely further promote tension. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee, by a 17-5 vote, passed the Taiwan Policy Act of 2022, the TPA. The act, if it becomes law, would significantly expand the scope of U.S. involvement in Taiwan's defense and promote its independent status. The act supports the official U.S. policy of One China, but shrinks its meaning, substituting what the committee majority considers strategic clarity for the long-standing U.S. policy toward Taiwan of strategic ambiguity. The act's emphasis on substantial military aid to Taiwan in weapons transfers, training and grants, all in close coordination and with directions for U.S. whole-of-government strategic planning to deter Beijing, has all the appearances of preparation for war. Liberals joined conservatives to push the act forward. Another sign of how the bipartisan congressional consensus on China has fully embraced a hostile relationship with Beijing. The consensus has led to numerous pieces of legislation, all with full administration support, that are driven by the downturn in U.S.-China relations and the aim to decouple cooperation. When it comes to the TPA, Democrats and Republicans are largely of one mind. For example, our own Senator Jeff Merkley said, "If we don't crank up our support for Taiwan, there will be a military offensive against Taipei." The Senate committee's top Republican, Senator Jim Risch of Idaho, said the legislation gives Xi Jinping reasons to think twice about invading Taiwan. Yes, it does, but in the wrong way, by provoking China to take action. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi recently, in a speech in New York, said the TPA threatens the foundations of China-U.S. relations. Should Taiwan be mishandled, he said, it is most likely to devastate our bilateral relations. Let me clarify my own position on Taiwan. With its 23 million people, its democratic system, and its first-class economy, Taiwan is very important. It is also the eighth largest U.S. trade partner, an important investor and job producer in the U.S. economy, and a world leader in computer chips production. If China carried out an unprovoked attack on Taiwan, the U.S. should certainly defend the island. In fact, Taiwan has been a major recipient of U.S. military aid for decades, so much so that Taiwan has a backlog of $14 billion in undelivered weapons. Now, under Biden, U.S. arms support is exceptional, with stunning new weapons packages worth over $6 billion that the administration and Congress are pushing for approval this year. Those sales, a boon to Raytheon and other weapons makers, may be more than Taiwan can actually absorb, as the TPA's emphasis on Taiwan's need for improved military preparedness for various contingencies suggests. Defending Taiwan should be accomplished in ways that do not invite precisely the situation we want to avoid, an aggressive Chinese response. Yes, China has stepped up its own provocative actions against Taiwan, mainly to signal its concern that the independent direction Taiwan seems to be headed toward with U.S. and specifically the Biden administration's encouragement. Beijing has also published a new white paper on Taiwan that substantially reduces the once promised autonomy under the one country, two systems unification policy. But Xi Jinping has made clear that Chinese policy remains peaceful unification. And so long as that is the case, strategic ambiguity, coupled with U.S. support of Taiwan's political autonomy and defense self-sufficiency, is the wisest policy course. In fact, polls in Taiwan consistently show that most people want President Tsai Ing-wen to maintain the current policy of rejecting both unification with China and Taiwan independence. The best thing that can be said about the TPA is that it is unlikely to pass. The Biden administration reportedly doesn't like it, though in a 60 Minutes interview on September 18, Biden, for the fourth time and contrary to standing policy, said that U.S. forces would defend Taiwan with troops if China attacked. Enough senators seem more cautious about making an advance commitment of that specificity and adding to the antagonism in U.S.-China relations. They deserve our support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 4th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips to 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mary Sherman, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegedoff, Mike Moen, Suzanne Potter, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm speaking today with progressive radio host and author Tom Hartman about his new book, The Hidden History of Neoliberalism: How Reaganism Gutted America and How to Restore Its Greatness. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, Althea. Great being back with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So your new book, what we're talking about today, it's a fantastic read, really a whirlwind through the history and the thinkers that brought us to our current economic state. To start here, how do you define neoliberalism? How does it differ from other terms, right? I know for folks it can be kind of confusing because liberalism in economics is different from what we call liberalism in politics.
Yeah, first a little background for Americans. In Europe, the UK is sort of the exception is, but by and large in Europe, the word liberal means what here in the United States we mean if we say libertarian or laissez-faire. It means unregulated, you know, capitalism, generally speaking. And this word came out of a meeting, the first meeting in Paris and then a subsequent meeting in Switzerland in 1947, as I recall, or maybe it was 43, whatever the year. Where Friedrich Hayek and von Mises and Milton Friedman and a bunch of economists and a few other hangers-on were trying to solve the question of, or the problem of, how can we make democracies resilient enough that they won't, like Germany had, become fascist in Italy, or like Russia did, become communist. You know, how can we kind of keep to the middle way? And being economists, you know, to paraphrase Abraham Maslow's old saying, you know, when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem in the world looks like a nail. They assumed that an economic system would solve the problem of democracies, you know, going astray. And that, you know, that economic system, they were big believers in liberalism in as much as, you know, like deregulation, laissez-faire economics, government hands-off, small government, low taxes, free trade, you know, little interference in business. They were big believers in that. but they wanted this, but they were going way, way beyond just that. And so they wanted this to be the new liberalism, thus the word neoliberalism. Now, to describe it, I just kind of went through a quick list there, but, you know, the main tenets or the main philosophical tenet of neoliberalism is, it sounds quite credible. And that is that because in the marketplace, literally every minute, a million decisions are being made. I mean, all across America right now, people are deciding which loaf of bread to buy, you know, which gas station to buy their gas from, what car to buy. They're making, and all of those decisions in aggregate are, you know, reflecting a kind of collective wisdom that far exceeds the ability of any elected official or bureaucrat to know what people want and how things should be. And so basically the core premise of neoliberalism is essentially abandon democracy or you know, democratic countries should really just be about having police and armies, you know, just protect us from the predators. And pretty much everything else, all the other decisions of a country should be made by those with the most money, because they're the ones that have been most successful in the economy. Therefore, they have the claim to the greatest intelligence and the greatest data. And so corporations should be persons. Persons should be essentially subordinate to corporate rule. Taxes on the very rich and on corporations should be super low or even non-existent. You should not have labor unions. They're considered an interference in the magic of the marketplace. We should individual employers should be able to search anywhere in the world they want for the cheapest labor, thus so-called free trade. You know, I think those are the big ones, essentially. I mean, there's a lot of kind of more subtle stuff that comes underneath that we're seeing. Oh, private, anything the government can do can be more efficiently done if it's, you know, done through private corporations. And therefore, like, for example, Joe Manchin got this neoliberal reform added to the bipartisan